On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
The take from us was, this is pissing us off because we don't see why there should still be an award for diversity and why there should need to be an award for diversity.
Betsy Beers is the executive producer of some of television's best-rated and most diverse shows, Grey's Anatomy, Scandal, and How to Get Away with Murder. But when the Directors Guild gave Beers and her partner, Shonda Rhimes, a diversity award, they were less than thrilled. Beers tells us why she's sick of talking about diversity and how an all-woman producing duo locked down Thursday nights on ABC. And KCRW's Saul Gonzalez checks in on the headshot, still a staple of the industry despite changing technology. But first, on an awards-themed news banter, the season struggles to find a frontrunner. And The Martian, how funny was that movie? Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my banter buddy, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hello there, Kim.
So, the Oscar race. We are well underway. Many events, screenings, fake holiday parties that are really Oscar parties.
How dare you? How dare you suggest that we would all be invited to a party and there would be some ulterior motive?
Right. You know, even the Governor's Awards, which were supposed to be honoring people like Debbie Reynolds, who unfortunately couldn't attend, turned out to be this, you know, people were like, it was campaign central. All these contenders showed up.
You're suggesting that Johnny Depp and Sam Jackson, they're not big Debbie Reynolds and Jenna Rollins fans? Didn't want to just come out for that?
I'm a cynical person. You know, what we see so far, we've seen a lot of the movies in contention, a lot that should be in contention or meant to be in contention. And strikingly, there is no front runner. If there is a front runner right now, I would have to say it is Spotlight, which is the film about the Boston Globe uncovering the Catholic Church child sex abuse scandal and the extent of it. And that's an ensemble play. And, you know, people really like it. So I don't know whether you agree, but I would say that one is, in fact, in the front position right now.
Yeah, I mean, I should preface this by saying that neither you nor I are licensed Oscar prognosticators.
That is true.
We do not claim to have, you know, predicted 20 out of the 27 categories last year or anything like that. There is a lot of goodwill towards Spotlight. I think it's got a long way to go. I mean, there are films that have not been seen yet by many people, including The Revenant, Jennifer Lawrence's movie with David O. Russell, Joy, Quentin Tarantino's movie, Hateful Eight, even the Star Wars movie, probably could sneak in as best picture if it's good, like, you know, the first
Star Wars sneaks
did.
Anywhere. I think it just kind of barges, but yes, if it's really good, well, it could be in the race. Yeah,
the first Star Wars got a best picture nomination,
there
so perhaps it could. The first Rocky got a best picture nomination, and, you know, Creed is getting a lot of attention. So I just feel like the race is so wide open at this point that it's really hard to say that anything is a front runner.
Yeah, I mean, just to run through a quick list, Revenant is obviously Alejandro González Iñárritu's follow to Birdman, and it is set out in the middle of the Canadian wilderness in the 19th century with Leo DiCaprio.
Even that movie has a problem, because if these guild members that were so upset about the conditions on that film, and by all accounts, according to the reporting that you've done, there were some very, very difficult and some say overly dangerous conditions on that film. If those guild members go public, that movie could have a difficult time overcoming that narrative.
Well, and there have been guild members who've gone on the record saying that it was dangerous, and that is not something that plays particularly well. And since Iñárritu won last year, I also think that would be a factor. I think it probably gets nominated, but whether it wins or not, I don't know. Ridley Scott could be a big contender, certainly in the director category. He hasn't won one. The Martian is, you know, probably, I think people agree, one of his best movies ever. And I think The Martian is a commercial hit, and it's fun, and I think it will at least get nominated. Room is well regarded with Brie Larson, and she is a strong contender in the actress category. Brooklyn with Saoirse Ronan, another contender for a nomination, certainly. So those are some of the movies that round out the field right now. And who knows?
Yeah, another movie I wouldn't count out is Bridge of Spies, the Steven Spielberg film. It got pretty good reviews when it came out, but it skews older and it skews towards people who remember the Cold War and have vivid memories of that period. And I think a lot of Academy voters fall into that category. And Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks are both beloved figures. I have heard that film is playing very well at screenings.
Yeah, I think that I agree completely. You know, that's a film that could kind of be a stealth player in all of this. They've really been very low key. You know, with Lincoln, they were laying it on with a trowel about this is a movie that should win an Oscar. And this one, they've gone completely the other way and they're just letting it go and run. And I think it's working in a way.
Yeah, there are a couple films that I wonder whether the failure at the box office is going to impact them. One is Steve Jobs, which I really enjoyed and I thought was a fantastic, unique, original film, and Michael Fassbender is amazing. I just wonder that it got so much attention for doing so poorly at the box office that I just wonder if it shot itself in the foot. The other one is Truth, the Dan Rather movie with Cate Blanchett and Robert Redford. I really enjoyed that film and I know it's been attacked as being one-sided and that doesn't really bother me. It's one person's story. But I think the fact that it didn't do well at the box office is going to hurt that film.
Yeah, and I think when there's controversy about something that truly happened, like we saw it with Zero Dark Thirty, that makes the Academy nervous. We certainly saw with Selma, there was backlash about how LBJ was portrayed. That is damaging. I think when the Academy members are confronted with that, they sort of are not sure whether it's correct to vote for or not vote for the movie, and they just back away.
There's also another terrific Cate Blanchett performance this year in Carol that the Academy members could gravitate towards. She and Rooney Mara are both amazing in the film, and I would be surprised if that film wasn't a major factor.
Yeah, we have a pretty strong, I mean, say exceptionally strong. Sometimes actress, it's not a great category this year. It's white. It's a white category. But, you know, Brie Larson in Room, Saoirse Ronan in Brooklyn, Cate Blanchett in Carol, probably not Truth. Charlotte Rampling in the movie 45 Years, very strong performance. And Jennifer Lawrence, of course, always a threat, although maybe the Academy will take, unless this movie is just outstanding, I think they may feel that she's been recognized. You know, she's gotten a couple of statuettes already.
Perhaps, but she's also the biggest movie star in Hollywood right now, so I think people gravitate towards that as well. On the actor side, I think it would be a shame if people like Johnny Depp, who's terrific in Black Mass, Michael Fassbender and Steve Jobs, Michael Caine has an amazing performance in a film called Youth, and Will Smith is great in Concussion, which is the NFL head trauma movie that I saw and really enjoyed. It's very controversial. It's going directly after the NFL and their role in this head trauma crisis that they've been suffering. Will Smith plays a Nigerian doctor and has an amazing accent in the film. I thought he was terrific.
And of course, there's Matt Damon and Sam Jackson in Hateful Eight. There's no short of strong performances and at least a couple of actors of color who could get in there and make the Academy Awards a little bit more diverse, which is something that's in the conversation a lot right now. There are a couple of movies that, you know, we haven't talked about also potentially could be recognized in multiple categories. One of them is Love and Mercy, which, you know, was a really unusual, well-done film about the life of Brian Wilson. And the other is Straight Outta Compton, which was a Universal movie. And, you know, Warner Brothers didn't want to make the movie, their New Line division, at the price that the producers wanted to make it at. They were fearful, you know. And, of course, it's very knee-jerk in Hollywood to say it's urban and let it go. And Universal saw it as much more than that, and it was much more than that. It played very, very well.
Yeah, this movie's done, $200 million worldwide, and it got great reviews, so it's no surprise they're doing an awards campaign, and Ice Cube and the film stars are out and about promoting the film for awards. F. Gary Gray is doing a lot of interviews, the director. I wouldn't be surprised if this film got a Best Picture nomination, and the young actor Jason Mitchell, who plays Eazy-E, got a Supporting Actor nomination.
Yes. And speaking of supporting actor, Creed, this movie that is like a Rocky, I don't know, I hate to call it a Rocky sequel, but Sylvester Stallone plays a much older version of the character in this, getting great reviews, and people are talking about him in Best Supporting Actor. And, you know, that one is another movie that could turn out to be a player in all of this. I think you would agree.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing right now is it's wide open. In past years, at this point, we had already seen Boyhood last year, and everyone thought that was a front runner.
Yeah, long since. Yeah, it opened
and,
early.
You know, Yeah, and we had seen Whiplash, and J.K. Simmons ended up winning supporting actor for that. Patricia Arquette won supporting actress for Boyhood, and people kind of knew that was going to happen at this point. This year, there's really nothing set in stone.
Well, speaking of nothing set in stone, the Golden Globes, boy, nothing is set in stone when it comes to the Golden Globes categories. The Golden Globes, this has been discussed for many years, people disparage it, and yet they built it into this juggernaut of an awards show. Everybody who's campaigning for Oscar feels compelled to show up and behave themselves so that they don't come across as ungracious and hurt themselves, as Eddie Murphy did when he was campaigning for Dreamgirls. And so the Globes are a big deal, and they've tried to be taken more seriously, and yet they do things, Matt, that makes it hard, right?
My favorite this year is they're allowing Fox to submit The Martian as a comedy.
Because it was hilarious.
I mean, Matt Damon had some funny lines in it,
yes,
but it's funny.
Did.
I'm looking at Hollywood Reporter magazine right now, and there's an ad in that issue for The Martian, a For Your Consideration ad, and Matt Damon is crying in the ad, and everything.
Tears of laughter.
No. But Jeff Daniels is looking very solemn. Chiwetel Ejiofor is looking very serious. This movie is not a comedy. It's a thriller. It's a sci-fi epic. It's a great movie, but it's not a comedy. And the Globes just kind of let you do what you want to do because they figure they have a better shot of getting a Best Picture nomination if it's in the comedy category.
Yeah, it's kind of shameless. It does not help their bid for credibility. And, you know, I have to credit Love and Mercy, which is a movie that could really use the attention and could have said, well, it's a musical, but they didn't do that. And obviously, The Martian wanted to avoid competition in the drama category, and it was permitted.
And you know what? It may work, and they'll get the nomination they want, and it will help their campaign, and they'll all laugh at us.
It may well work because they want the stars to come out there, and you know, they would love to be able to say, Matt Damon, you need to be here, as well as, you know, Leo DiCaprio for The Revenant. You need to be here.
Yeah, and they're both Fox. Fox has an embarrassment of quality this year. They have The Martian, they have Joy, they have The Revenant. You know, they have a lot of films. Fox is not always a big player in the awards race, and this year they really are.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. These days, it involves pixels instead of paper, but if you're a working actor, you still need a good headshot, which means there are still photographers who specialize in capturing that perfect picture. KCRW's Saul Gonzalez spent a day with some pros and brings us this report.
Good. Hold that right there. Tilt your head a little this way. Good. Good. Perfect. Teeny little smirk like you got a big fat secret. Good.
It's an entertainment industry ritual that happens in photography studios across Los Angeles every day. An actor getting headshots.
Hold that right there. There you go.
That's the Rob smile.
Nice. Good.
Even as Hollywood changes, with movies seen on the smartphone screen as well as the big screen, and fans asking celebrities for selfies instead of autographs, the headshot and its importance endures.
Well, they're your first entry. It's the first view of who you are. It's the strangest calling card that anybody might ever have.
Rob Nagel is your quintessential working Hollywood actor. He's often cast as the goofy suburban dad in commercials or a murder suspect in cop shows. But as Rob gets older, he's looking for more complex roles, like maybe what you'd see on HBO. And Rob thinks the headshots he's getting today are key to that goal.
More than anything else, I just want to look at some pictures and see something new in myself so that I, as well as people who have seen my photos before, look at me and think, oh, that's a side of Rob I've never seen. I never thought of him for that.
Taking Rob's photos today is Stephanie Girard, a well-known and respected headshot photographer, especially among Hollywood's legion of character actors. She's also one of the handful of women in this business.
Good, 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 good. Go ahead and turn your body a little bit this way.
Stephanie says a good headshot session is part photography, part psychology.
I think something people don't know is as photographers, headshot photographers specifically working with actors, we end up being therapists a lot of the time. That the actors really kind of open up during the session and we get to know them. And, you know, when there's a camera in someone's face, I think their insecurities tend to come out, and the good, the bad, the ugly, it all comes out. So you end up learning a lot more than just someone's face, but inside them too.
Along with that, Stephanie and other headshot photographers must also work with a younger generation of actors who were weaned on trading their photos on social media. And she says that often affects how they pose for the camera.
We call it the selfie nation. When you get the younger actors in here, they're used to posing for the camera a certain way.
Meaning they do the pursed lips look and that kind of
selfie pose.
Kind of
tilt their head, hand on the hip, which, you know, it's fine for social media and they probably look gorgeous in all their Instagram photos. But when you're being photographed professionally, it's a little different. It's a little different. And some of them have a hard time breaking that habit, or they don't trust that, oh, I can be photographed both sides, or if I put my chin down or out, that will actually look better. And some of them, we have to bring them around and actually show them on camera.
While headshots snapped with a selfie stick are definitely not okay, the style of these photographs has evolved over time. 20 years ago, the headshots were often in black and white, and there was way more of an emphasis on heavier makeup, striking poses, and dress up.
The photos are more real now. It's not the black turtleneck and the posing with your hand under your chin kind of thing. It's a much more natural approach. It's not as posed, I think. And the wardrobe has changed drastically. So these actors now have to kind of hint at their type without playing characters in their photos. The days of actors wearing a lab coat, you know, because they want to show they can play a doctor, they're almost totally gone.
But the biggest change is technological. Headshots don't get printed nearly as much on 8x10 sheets of glossy prints that you can hold in your hands. As with so many things, it's now all digital, the headshots existing only in computers and on thumb drives. And that's changed how casting directors, whose job it is to match the right faces with the right roles, do their jobs.
In your 25 years of doing this, how many headshots have you seen?
I'm going to say probably at least 30 to 40,000, at least.
30 to 40,000 headshots seen.
Yep. Yes, that's why I wear glasses.
That's casting agent Danielle Askenazi. She says in the old days of headshots printed on paper, just looking through them all could be an industrial scale operation, but not anymore.
We don't ever, ever look at headshots anymore.
You never physically touch an 8x10 piece of paper anymore.
And I love that.
You love it. What's good about it?
I could see things so much faster. I don't have to hire, you know, if I'm doing three or four jobs at a time, I don't have to hire five assistants to look after each job and open one by one, put them in different categories. Now it's just a matter of clicking, and there's 100 headshots on a sheet electronically, and I just push buttons. That's all I do is push buttons and go through the ones that I like.
But now that it's possible to look at so many thumbnail-sized faces so quickly on computer screens, that puts extra pressure on headshot photographers like Stephanie Girard to take photos that capture the eye of a harried casting director or producer. After all, a career could be riding on it.
So the power of the thumbnail popping, we kind of call it the pop factor now, is massively important. Because if not, you'll just get lost. Those of us that work consistently in the business, we all have to up our game because it's so competitive for the actor, you know, that you have to get them the best shot that you possibly can.
That's what Stephanie hopes she's accomplished in her session with actor Rob Nagel. After the shoot, they sit down together at her computer and start reviewing the best headshots that will get Rob the best roles.
Which one surprises you the most?
I love that one.
It's interesting. Yeah.
I think that one's very, very marketable.
Yeah.
Commercially, I know agents love smiling shots, but I feel like that's the shot that's going to get you the roles you play in commercials.
Yeah,
more so
true.
Than that, as far as...
And with that, Stephanie gets ready for her next client, another actor who hopes that the right headshot could lead to the next gig, and maybe, just maybe, fame and fortune.
Good. Drop the chin just a little. Perfect. Little tilt.
For KCRW's The Business, I'm Saul Gonzalez.
Coming up after a short break, producer Betsy Beers tells us about launching Grey's Anatomy and building the Shondaland Empire. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Everything should be fine. This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters.
Scandals all new with a love triangle on steroids.
I'm asking the married man who used to sleep with my friend what exactly he has done with the man she's currently sleeping with.
Can't wait.
And on how to get away with murder, the shocks just keep on coming.
What the hell is going on here?
Thank God it's Thursday. Tonight.
If you have a Thursday night viewing habit that includes Grey's Anatomy, Scandal, and or How to Get Away with Murder, you're watching shows from Shonda Rhimes and our guest today, producer Betsy Beers. Even in the age of delayed viewing, their suspenseful dramas draw huge live numbers, frequently more than 8 million viewers per show. Those programs also stand out for their diverse casts. This year, Viola Davis made history when she became the first African-American woman to win an Emmy for Best Actress in a Drama for her role in How to Get Away with Murder.
And let me tell you something. The only thing that separates women of color from anyone else is opportunity. You cannot win an Emmy for roles that are simply not there.
Before joining Shondaland, Betsy Beers worked in film development, but originally she intended to make her name in front of the camera. Beers recently sat down with Joe Adalian and Michael Schneider, the hosts of the KCRW TV podcast, The Spinoff.
I was sure I went to New York, and I was sure that, you know, I was going to be the next Lady Macbeth. And very quickly, I realized that nobody wanted to hire me to play Lady Macbeth. But I found that I had more of a likelihood that I would be hired in comedy roles, and I kept getting hired as sort of either really old people, which is odd because I was in my 20s, and I guess that just tells you something about what I was looking like at the time. Either that or I was worried a lot. I have no clue. I guess old before my time. But I found this improv group downtown and joined that and found that I loved that world. And then somebody in the group and I split off and created our own group. But yeah, I did that for several years and then moved out to California in the hopes of being a wacky next-door neighbor in a sitcom. And that also didn't go so good, as it turned out.
No. And did you make it onto any pilots?
No, I got nothing. I got here and I started to audition, and it was the late 80s, and I thought, all my agents in New York told me I could be a wacky next-door neighbor.
Yeah, and really, that was the height of the wacky next-door neighbor.
Oh my
that
God.
Was the age of
was,
the wacky
next-door
neighbor.
It was like there should be shows just called Wacky Next-Door Neighbor.
Yeah.
But I found that most people wanted Suzanne Summers. Like, they wanted, you know, comely and fabulous and lots of giggling, and I was not comely nor fabulous, and people kept suggesting, maybe you need a nose job. That would work. Some other things could be augmented potentially.
Oh, Hollywood.
Oh, Hollywood, yes.
I love it. And so I couldn't get a job waitressing, which I am very good at, by the way. So I found out about this thing called reading. And I learned how to read scripts and do story notes. And over the course of like 2 or 3 months, that sort of transmogrified into a job where I got a job at a studio reading. And then I recommended a movie, which was called I'm Gonna Get You, Sucka. And they said, oh, we'll let you work on the movie. And I thought, this development thing is the easiest job I've ever seen in my life. So I actually had a dark night of the soul, and I thought about it, and I realized that this was coming very naturally to me, and acting clearly didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So I shut the door on that, and I got to say, I never looked back.
How did you actually meet Shonda? She just mentioned movies, I guess. So how did that come together?
I was working at the time for a producer named Mark Gordon, and she was a very successful, excellent screenwriter, and she was looking to develop a television show. We just recently sort of officially entered the television arena, and a woman who I knew who had I used to work with, and she called and said, you know, there's this writer I love who I think you would really hit it off with her, and she wants to develop a television show, and that was Shonda. So Shonda, who was meeting producers all over town and trying to figure out who she wanted to develop with, came in and sat down, and we kind of hit it off immediately. We shared a lot of the same sort of literary influences, and she has a really good sense of humor. I felt immediately comfortable.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. I seem to remember the first project that you guys developed for ABC was the War Correspondents project. Obviously, it didn't move forward, and I assume you learned a lot in that sort of you played into developing
grades. Oh, my God. We learned a ton. She wrote an amazing script. It was loosely based on source material about female war correspondents who traveled to this foreign country, and essentially it was sort of like being embedded. And these women, all of whom knew each other because they were always being put in the same spot all over the world. And I think we got actually pretty close to getting picked up, but the war had actually just recently broken out.
Yeah.
This was after, obviously, 9/11. And so they decided not to pick it up because they didn't think the time was right. Now, the other thing I have to tell you, though, about it was I think we'd both come from movies, so we had no idea what a TV budget was.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a whole section, I remember, with tanks coming into a large city with thousands of people. And I remember now we went back and read it a while ago, and I thought, this is a $25 million pilot that we wrote, like that thing you wrote. But yeah, it was a really, really great experience. And we both realized we really, really liked working together, that we'd had a really good time. So she came back the next year and we tried to think of something else that would be a great television show to do. And she was really interested in the world of medicine. And she had thought, I think, in the past about, this is well documented, but she thought about being a surgeon. And my thing about medical shows was I never understood them. They're always running around and they're poking people with things and they're yelling and mm-hmm. there's lots of stats and people, you know, punching people with equipment. I mean, I understand it sort of, but I don't. She said, well, it's great because there are these things called interns and they don't know what they're doing either. And I said, great, a television show for me. I don't know what I'm doing either. So she said, well, we could tell it from the point of view of interns. And then she did that thing where she just went off and she percolated it in her big brain and handed this pitch that was actually pretty close to what Grey's Anatomy ended up being.
And that was 12 years ago.
Can
you believe it's been that long?
I know. And sometimes I can, and then other times I really can't. Honestly, if I really thought about it, no, I don't think it's been 12 years. I would have said maybe 6.
So, Betsy, I want to ask you something else. The Shondaland shows, they've been truly breakthrough in terms of colorblind casting and helping advance diversity in prime time. But I also know that's a topic that you guys don't love talking about. I think people bring it up because they want to sort of pay respect and compliment and
yeah.
say, like,
yeah.
Shondaland, you guys really did open the door. And Shonda kind of bristles sometimes when it comes up at, say, TCA.
Mm-hmm.
You guys don't really want to constantly have to discuss this and like have that on your shoulders. At the same time, it's a cool deal. So how do you sort of reconcile that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we've addressed this in different ways in the past, and a couple of years ago, we got the award from the DGA, and the take from us was, this is pissing us off because we don't see why there should still be an award for diversity and why there should need to be an award for diversity. I think the main thing about it is, look, we cannot imagine a world in which it is not diverse. That's the world we live in. When we first started talking about Grey's Anatomy, our biggest conversation was always about she wanted to create a world in which it looked like us and it felt like us. We were two women who didn't necessarily see ourselves on TV. We didn't see the kinds of relationship we had with our coworkers, with our friends. And that's just speaking as women on TV. I think the problem right now is that diversity is sort of being treated like a fad
mm-hmm.
or a trend. And it's not. It's not a fad. It's been around forever. It's just people now have just decided to start talking about it. So I think it's something that we don't drive into the conversation as much because it's something that we feel like is part of our world. And in a weird way, the people who should be talking about it are the people who aren't portraying worlds like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that they should be talking about it. It's just that maybe ask them. But it's definitely the way we see the world. And I think it's a great world we're living in.
That was Shondaland executive producer Betsy Beers talking to Michael Schneider and Joe Adalian, the hosts of KCRW's podcast, The Spinoff. You can hear the rest of their conversation and check out other episodes on kcrw.com/thespinoff. And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.